good morning and welcome to the Athenaeum Review podcast. I'm Ben Lima, and I'm very honored today to have with us Marianne Corbett, who is an award-winning, distinguished, widely published poet, as well as a medievalist and linguist. Her book, The O in the Air, is out from Franciscan University Press, and there's a lot more on her website at mariannecorbett.com. She's also on Twitter, also known as X, where you can learn a lot about poetry by following her. And she's also the translator of Autre Ballade by Christine de Pizan. And I'm very happy that three of these translations will appear in the winter 2024 issue of Athenaeum Review. Thanks very much for being here.
Thank you, Ben, for having me.
Well, I wondered if I could ask you to start to give just a brief introduction to Christine de Pizan. Who is she and who was she as a writer?
A scholar once called Christine de Pizan the first modern woman. She lived during the late 14th and early 15th centuries and was the first woman in France and possibly in Europe known to have supported herself and her family by means of her writing. She was also one of the first vernacular writers to supervise the copying and illumination of her own books. The condensed version of her life goes like this. Her father had been the court astrologer in the court of France's Charles V, and her husband a court notary. But when both father and husband died, Christine was on her own, responsible for three children and other family members. At that point, she had to, as she herself put it, become a man. She began by using her court connections to gain patrons for her writing, but she soon made a name for herself as a thinker in her own right. In a time when medieval views of women's role were still distressingly negative, Christine made a vigorous defense of women's nature and abilities. We can think of her as the first proto-feminist in the West and even the first woman humanist in the Renaissance sense of that term.
That's amazing. She sounds like really a remarkable person. So many firsts. So early. I wonder maybe for those who aren't as familiar with the period in which she's writing, if you could discuss a little bit about kind of the historical context of her work and what people were writing and thinking about and what she sort of had in the background as she was working.
Christine's life. And incidentally, I keep calling her Christine and not de Pizan because the second part of her name isn't like a modern surname. It's a loconym based on the place her family came from, which was Pizzano in Italy. Christine's life from 1364 to about 1430 stretched across a period of enormous upheaval in England. And for readers of poetry in English, this whole time is the Middle Ages and takes in the work of Chaucer and Gower and William Langland and the Pearl Poet, the medieval notions of chivalry and of courtly love, which is basically a refined notion of adultery, are still very popular, alongside the church's official view of woman as the font of all sin. But in Italy, the Renaissance is starting. There's the rediscovery of the literature of Greece and Rome. Boccaccio and Petrarch have been writing for decades before Christine was born. And in her own books, she introduced their work to French readers. In the church, there were huge problems with what's called the Western Schism, a long period when there were rival popes, one in Rome and one in Avignon, and kings and courts had to decide which one to back, which was troublesome for Christine's patrons. And yawning over everything else, there's the Hundred Years' War between France and England, with five generations of kings from rival dynasties fighting over the territory of France from 1337 to 1453. Readers of English poetry tend to think of that conflict in terms of the English victory at Agincourt and the wonderful speech that Shakespeare puts in the mouth of Henry V. But for France, the period was a terrible time, with many of Christine's noble patrons losing family members or having to negotiate for their ransom. And to top it all off, at the end of Christine's life, King Charles VI is, to put it simply, out of his mind. So it was a fraught time in all sorts of ways. Christine's last known poem is a work in praise of Joan of Arc and the victory at Orléans. And because Joan was executed in 1431, we think Christine must have died before that time and been unaware of that sad outcome.
That's so interesting. I just, there are a couple of things that came to mind as I was thinking about what you're saying. One, with the amount of kind of misogyny that she was, you know, reacting to and responding to, how it was kind of received or whether you think she succeeded in kind of changing minds. But another angle of that, when you mention Renaissance humanism, would it be fair to say that she viewed humanism as a kind of resource that she could use for a more kind of humane view of women and the relation between men and women?
When she gets to the period of her writing that is her own, shall we say, and goes beyond court poetry, she relies heavily on the classics as she knows them, learning them from Boccaccio, Petrarch, and others. But it takes her a while to get there. Her earliest poems in the book called 100 Ballades capitalize on her court connections and the popularity of forms like the ballade and the poetry of love. Probably her best known poem is from that early period, the poem called Seule je suis, I am alone, her famous lament about the death of her husband. And in that first book, much is conventional. Occasionally, there's criticism of what somebody is doing at court. But at that point, the most daring thing that she does is to criticize the ideal of courtly love, which she doesn't trust. The real turning point in her writing comes in about 1400 when she gets involved in a debate among academics, a debate about the very popular poem called The Romance of the Rose. There's a lot one could say about that poem, but to be brief, the part of the poem written by Jean de Meung is bitingly satirical and deeply misogynistic. So when a cleric named Jean de Montreuil writes a public letter in praise of the Jean de Meung material, Christine writes back and she blazes away. And letters back and forth on the subject pass for years, for several years, always including Christine. And they build up her reputation as a thinker. So at the end of that exchange of letters, when things finally just sort of fritter away, by then her reputation as a woman of letters was solid enough for her to seek commissions for other kinds of writing. And that eventually produced her history of her own thinking called Christine's Vision, which is how we learn about her life. That's where she tells us all about it and her development. And then come the famous books in defense of women, the Book of the City of Ladies, the Book of the Three Virtues, and then books on a wide range of political subjects like a biography of Charles V, political treatises, mirrors for princes, sayings on morality, an interpretation of the Psalms, and even a book on military strategy. But the period of Christine's life that I'm most interested in, since I'm a poet and I want to translate poetry, is the period when She has become deeply invested in the debate on the status of women, but she's still writing court poems. And the reason I'm interested is that some of those poems convey her anger and exasperation with the men she's debating and the abuse she's taking from them. If I may, I will go along with reading one poem along that line.
Please, please, please.
This is Ballade 17 from Autre Ballade. Back when Circe the sorceress changed into pigs the warrior Greeks, Ulysses yanked them from that mess by dint of certain canny tricks. But for some men I'm furious with, that wouldn't be a just outcome, since they're more vile than pigs in filth. No insult's bad enough for them. They're braggarts, short on battle fame, with gear that's good for looking at, proud of their noble family names, although their bodies run to fat, and yet they're not ashamed of that. One hardly dares to say such stuff. They've little fondness for the right. Is there a libel cruel enough? There is no lady, right or wrong, of high or humble situation, who's safe from wounding by the tongues they wag about her reputation. Calmly twisting rumor's knife, smearing, they make themselves unclean, more pleased with murder than with life. For that, no insult is too mean. I'm not a fan of insults, but for worse than Judas's, it's tough, as they're so fond of lies and smut. For them, no insult's bad enough.
Wow. That's really wonderful. Thank you.
Shall I go on with the second one?
Yes, yes, yes. Oh, please, please, please. No, we would love it, please. Which one is this?
Well, this one is a little different. This is the second ballade from 100 Ballades of a Lover and a Lady. Mm-hmm. And I want to get to that one because after she finishes Autre Ballades, well, writing for patronage means you have to keep your patrons happy. And at some point, something Christine said about courtly love displeased one of them. And even though she was becoming deeply uninterested in the conventions of courtly love, she was effectively ordered to start writing about it again. So that's the reason she wrote 100 Ballades of a Lover and a Lady, which traces the conventional, sad progress of a courtly affair, which always turns out badly for the lady. You can hear how resistant she is to the whole idea in this ballade, in which the lady responds to the lover's first sally. Love is unknown to me. The least desire to learn is absent from my thought. My mind's on other things. So your hope's vain. Take off your wild imaginings. I don't return such love. It is not proper for a lady who esteems her reputation. I regret your pains, but love is not in my plans, not yours, not any man's. Against a love like that, I mean to be on guard. I thank God that I won't be taken in the nets that snare so many to their great unhappiness. For my own good, I've passed them by so far and will pass by again. Sweet-spoken words and billet doux in graceful hands. Love isn't in my plans, not yours, not any man's. I don't know how to give you any other answer. Don't talk about it further. I'm already weary of listening. Go declare your passion to some other lady, because such pleas as yours will get no hearing. Whoever tries is spending effort in a foolish enterprise. Love isn't in my plans, not yours, not any man's.
That's amazing. Thank you. I think it was a little later on the outline that we had, but I wondered if you could say something about kind of how, you know, you as a translator of these poems, kind of how they strike you, or how you come to them, or what something about the process of rendering them in English, and how you kind of just go about that work.
My interest in Christine began in 2009 when I was participating in an online poetry forum called Erratosphere, where there was a very active group of translators. Our moderator proposed an activity for International Translation Day, which is September 30th. On some calendars, that's the feast day of St. Jerome, the patron saint of translators. Mm. And since Jerome has a reputation as a terrible misogynist, we decided to focus the event on women, to pick poetic translators, poems by women, and submit those translations and discuss them. And so I was casting about for a medieval woman who wrote in a language whose earlier forms I could manage, and I discovered Christine. I got to know her better when I wrote an essay about her for a project called the Mezzocamine Women Poets Timeline. And you can find that project online and should definitely give it a look. Like Christine's very earliest patrons, I kind of fell in love with the weepy poems about her widowhood, but I've graduated to the more sharp-tongued work that represents her mature position. Mm-hmm. Something that we have now that we didn't have back in 2009 is online access to many of the original manuscripts of Christine's mm-hmm. work. And a lot of those can be found at the Johns Hopkins Christine de Pizan Scriptorium. And there are not just the manuscripts, but a complete list of her works and their editions.
You know, there's so much to think about as I was listening to those, going back actually a few minutes ago, I think you said something to the effect of courtly love often simply having to do with adultery, and it made me think that, you know, the kind of rhetoric of let's cast off all convention in the name of nature and of quote unquote love. It can often be simply a way of kind of removing restraints on the powerful, taking advantage of the powerless, or, you know, she's clearly justifiably skeptical of some of what's done in the name of love. It just really seemed to me that kind of if the sense of love or courtly love that a reader would get from a male poet in this period would often be quite different from what she does. It's really so fascinating. I wondered if you could. So these are ballades, as you've said. For those who aren't as familiar, could you say something about what is a ballade as a type of form, as a type of poem?
Strictly speaking, what a ballade has to do in the modern form as it's now defined is that it has to have a specific rhyme scheme. Each stanza is in the pattern A, B, A, B, B, C, B, C. And every stanza ends with the same last line, a refrain. Usually there are three stanzas. In the modern ballade, there's always a last shorter stanza called an envoi or envoi in French, which means ascending, so that the poem as a whole is addressed to a particular person. Conventionally, that's a prince. Now, in Christine's time, the conventions were still taking shape, so a lot of the things that she calls ballades don't fit our exact modern definition. She has no problem with varying. She's very inventive about form and likes inventing new ones. modern poets, as you might expect, can get away with ignoring princes, or they can do with what I've done on occasion and write ballads that lament the lack of any princes just now who are yeah. worthy of dedicating anything to.
Yeah. Do poets often, I guess, you don't necessarily dedicate a poem to like a granting agency, like, you know, the Endowment for the Arts. I wondered if you could, I know we agreed that we're focusing on Christina Pizan, but obviously you're very accomplished as a writer of original poetry. And I wondered if, have you always done kind of both translation? I mean, along with your scholarly work, do you sort of do both composing your own poetry and translating kind of on separate tracks, or does it kind of overlap at all, or how you think about all that?
It tends to vary with the seasons. Uh-huh. My own poetry tends to slump in the wintertime, yeah. so I do a lot of translating in the winter.
Yeah.
And the two poems that I just read, plus the one that you're also going to publish in Athenaeum, happened last winter in a kind of a blitz of translating. Yeah. In the rest of the year, original poems, as they hit me, I am not the kind of poet who powers through, writes no matter what. I wait for the muse to strike.
Yeah.
And sometimes she goes on furlough.
Yes, yes. Well, I wondered, let's see, I mean, I know in the notes you mentioned, you just mentioned the scriptorium at Johns Hopkins, and you also mentioned Charity Cannon Willard as working on Christine de Pizan, but more broadly, I also wanted to ask for those, you know, like, let's say someone knows kind of Chaucer, or, you know, someone who maybe had, like myself, high school or undergrad literature and is not familiar with Christine. Aside from your own translations, I wondered if there are things that you would point to someone who wants to learn more about both her and kind of her world, and perhaps even other women authors of the time or her peers. Are there any references or books or authors that you'd point people to who are listening and might want to learn more?
Well, I'll start with Charity Cannon Willard's biography, Christine de Pizan, Her Life and Work. It's not a new book anymore. It was published in 1984, I believe, but it's still the seminal work because it's Charity Cannon Willard who basically offered Christine to readers of English for a number of centuries. She was really only known to readers of French. She'd been very popular in her own time. We know that because there were lots of manuscripts all listed in detail at that scriptorium site. Things kind of fall off during the Renaissance, along with the, shall we say, repression of all things medieval. Mm-hmm. And they come back again in the 19th century, along with the resurgence of all things medieval, but mostly that's for French readers. And it's Willard who gives us translations, critical articles, and this biographical material. The newer work, I think the best thing I can do is refer you to my article at the Mezzocamine Women Poets Timeline, where I've got a good long bibliography of contemporary work, scholarly and popular, about Christine.
Oh, that's excellent. I can make sure that we put links to that in when this goes online. I always like to ask if, you know, as far as what you're working on now, current projects, future projects, what your readers can look forward to in the future, if there's anything you want to mention that that people might check out in the upcoming days, weeks, months.
Well, I hope they will check out my very newest book, which is called The O in the Air, and which was just published last summer. Mm. It contains a certain amount of, shall we say, confessional work in the religious sense, as well as the life history sense. Things that are in the works include a book of funny poems, which I hope will be called Airheads, but that remains to be seen, and a more serious collection, which so far is called Notifications from the Unseen World.
Wonderful, wonderful. Thank you. Well, we've been talking today with Marianne Corbett, who's the translator of the Ballades of Christine de Pizan. Thanks very much for being here.
Thank you again.
And this is the Athenaeum Review podcast, and you can find out more at athenaeumreview.org.